This is an ABC podcast.
It's 30 years ago this year since Steven Spielberg did something scientists have never been able to. Yes, he brought the dinosaurs back, and his cult classic Jurassic Park turns 30 this year. Filmmakers are lucky like that, aren't they? They get to make the stuff of our imaginations real. But if scientists wanted to, could they engineer a Brontosaurus back into being? Andrew Pask?
So there's no DNA left in dinosaur bones, so we can forget the whole Jurassic Park scenario, team. I'm sorry to disappoint everybody. So DNA lasts about has a half-life of about 500 years. So in a couple of million years of any sample in a museum collection, there's no DNA left. So we can't go back 60 million for dinosaurs, nothing there, unfortunately, for, you know, the big Jurassic Park fans. But it means we're not going to get eaten by T-Rex, which is a good thing.
Yes, let's not end up as dinner for a reincarnated T-Rex. Hi, it's Natasha Mitchell. Welcome to Big Ideas. Can we bring animals back from the dead? That's today's big idea. And if we could, should we?
You know, I wouldn't recommend bringing back dinosaurs if we could get DNA from them. We can't. But if you could, you know, obviously this is not something that there's a habitat for, that there's a good reason for bringing back other than we would want to see it.
Well, Rod so, here wants to bring back Grandma.
That's a lot easier. I get asked about cloning humans all the time. I'm like, we've been able to do that for years.
We already are playing God in this way with human medicine.
Yeah.
And we're spending huge amounts of money globally on trying to grow patient-specific organs from their own cells, and that's going on as part of a way to have us live longer, allow us to, you know, survive our own individual extinctions.
Yeah. Mm.
And what we're suggesting is that bringing those tools to bear on wildlife and all the other species in biodiversity, the other 2 million species, and we estimate 10 million species on this planet that we share.
That's Dr. Kevin Rowe, curator of mammals at Museums Victoria, which is building a biobank to freeze the biological tissue of threatened species. Geneticist Professor Andrew Pask heads the team that sequenced the extinct Tasmanian tiger's genome. Now he's trying to engineer the enigmatic marsupial back into being. And paleontologist Myrene Bellisi specialises in extinct North American mammals like the saber-toothed cat and the dire wolf, and what they can tell us about animals facing extinction today. They're with me at a Melbourne Museum Future Forum with questions coming from the audience.
Given that we are responsible for making animals go extinct, all sorts of species go extinct, do you think that we have a moral obligation to try and bring them back? Andrew?
100%. Absolutely. I think if we have the technology now to undo some of the wrongs that we caused, I think we have to think very carefully about which species we want to bring back. They have to have somewhere to go. They have to have habitats, you know, that they can exist in. But I think if we have the technology and the ability to undo some of those wrongs, that we absolutely owe it to those species to do that.
Kevin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know from the deep time record, from the historical museum record, the huge impacts we've had on ecosystems, how we've disrupted communities globally, and ecosystems are suffering. Whatever we can do to help remedy those wrongs and bring about healthier ecosystems is going to mean for a more bountiful and beautiful planet to live on.
Myrene, do we have a moral obligation to bring back some of the species that you study, long extinct species that have not roamed this planet for potentially millennia?
Well, I think that that's a really interesting question. So, Natasha, you mentioned that one of my focal species has been the saber-toothed cat, Smilodon. This was a very large cat, larger than basically, all of the cats that we have in North America today. And I think that if we were to bring the saber-tooth back, that might cause more problems given people. So I think that it depends on the species. Kevin, you started mentioning ecosystems as well, and I think it really depends on what about extinct ecosystems we're trying to revive.
Yeah, what would we be bringing them back into? So, Andrew, what makes then the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, a good potential candidate to consider in your mind to bring back from extinction?
I actually think of all the examples for de-extinction, it is the best one. That's because it's a recent extinction event, so we're able to get really good quality DNA from the specimen. So that means we're not going to bring back something that we're filling in gaps or making up with other bits of other genomes. We're really confident that we've got an excellent complete genome build. But it's also a species that was a human-driven extinction, so this is something that we aggressively hunted and wiped off the face of the Earth. And it's a species for which the ecosystem still exists, which it once thrived in. So it's an animal that if we could bring that animal back tomorrow in its entirety, you could actually put back into that ecosystem in Tasmania. And it had enormously important benefits in that ecosystem. It was this incredibly unique animal, this apex predator, that sat right at the very top of the food chain. And there are no other Australian marsupials that fulfil that same role or that same niche. And so when it was lost from that ecosystem, it caused a huge imbalance. And I think for all of those reasons, if I was to pick anything, it would be the thylacine to try and do this with, because of all of those reasons. It's really got everything going for it for a de-extinction project.
But have you seen the roadkill in Tasmania lately? So if you brought it back, is it actually going to survive those roads?
There is a lot of roadkill there, but we would hope that, you know, it would become abundant enough, like all the most of the other species there, that it can definitely combat dealing with a bit of traffic and people.
Right. We've got a question then from Kengo, who's 8. Kengo wants to know, how do you bring the thylacine back to life?
It's a great question. So we still can't create life where there is none. So we can't actually go to museum specimen collections, find an extinct animal and somehow magically bring that back to life. So the way that these projects work is you look around in nature to find the closest living relative of your animal that went extinct. And then we can set up cells growing from that living animal. And then we compare their DNA. So we compare everything about their blueprint or their set of instructions on how to build that animal. And we look for everywhere that they're different. And they're not hugely different when it's a closely related species. There's a lot that needs changing, but it's not a massive amount. And then basically using DNA editing technology, we take that living cell and we edit it and change it into a thylacine genome or into that Tasmanian tiger genome. So you're basically engineering your Tasmanian tiger
into being.
Back into existence. Yeah, exactly. But that's a brief on how it works.
Very brief.
Yeah.
And you know, you make it sound like you could do it tomorrow.
Oh, it's a cinch. No. Yeah. This is incredibly complicated.
So this is hard stuff. What are the difficulties?
Really the scope of the edits that we need to make. So just going through and editing all of those changes is huge. But also we lack a lot of the basic technologies that we need to turn living cells into whole living animals in marsupials. So things like cloning, IVF, you know, simple assisted reproductive techniques, we really can't do yet in marsupials. And that's some of the things that we have to figure out in this project. But my real passion for this project is because all of those techniques have incredible conservation benefits for marsupials right now. We know we're facing this massive extinction. We know with events like the bushfires we had a few years ago that we run the risk of losing entire species of marsupials, but certainly a lot of their diversity in just, you know, one single adverse weather event. And if we are able to develop this technology of just taking marsupial cells and turning them back into whole living animals, then we can start to use a lot of these techniques to protect against the further loss of other marsupial species and make sure that if we do lose any of our modern day marsupials, that we can repopulate those animals once the bush is regenerated.
Ah, so many questions, so many ethical and social environmental questions that this work triggers. Kevin, you're interested, though, in using some of the techniques that Andrew and co are using to think about how can we keep the species that are on the brink now. And so you're focused, for example, on endangered rodents and particularly one very cute, gentle, beautiful specimen called the smoky mouse. But tell us about how you enter this conversation.
Well, like Andy said, these bushfire events and other declines in species are all reminders of what we're losing on the landscape, and we're losing in species. We're losing all this genetic diversity. And what these technologies allow us to do is when we encounter an animal through research or even if it's had a fatality or mortality, we can try to preserve its cells as living cells so that if we need to bring back that living genetic material, we have a much greater starting point than working with a thylacine that we've had in the collection for 113 years sitting dead in ethanol. And that's what our Living Biobank initiative is really about, is trying to preserve the living cells from animals in liquid nitrogen, cryopreserve them, and keep them alive for the next century to come, and so that we have access to that genetic diversity with future technologies and future needs.
So these are actually active projects happening now at the museum. So a living cell biobank, there's a DNA zoo, a frozen zoo.
The frozen zoo, is an initiative that started at San Diego Zoo, and it's actually pretty old. It started in 1975 to set aside living cells from animals in captivity, like rhinos and other things of conservation concern. And the technology was just really challenging to do and really could only do it in a laboratory space. And what we're trying to do, and which seems to, we're now at the point we can do, is collect cells from animals in the wild. Mm-hmm. So if we catch a smoky mouse, which we studied them, we've been studying them for more than 10 years in the Grampians, and we know that they're in these very small, narrow ranges there, and we've been tracking individuals. So we catch an individual, and we can take a small ear biopsy, which we typically take just for DNA samples. We're now able to sequence whole genomes from those individuals. Mm-hmm. Now we can, instead of just taking dead DNA, we can keep those cells from that ear alive, those skin cells, those fibroblast cells alive, and then we can culture them in our laboratory.
No animals were killed in the making of this this cryobank.
No. So yeah, part of what we're trying to understand is the survival of these animals. We have individual males that we've seen over a 5-year period living on these sites. We had a male go away for 4 years and come back last year. So we have these marked individuals. That's part of the science, is trying to track when their survival is lowest, what are the impacts of cats and foxes on this landscape? We have cats and foxes all through the landscape. When is their predation most at risk for the smoky mice? So this is all wrapped up in the understanding the ecology, mortality, and survival of individuals in this landscape. But then as we're watching them, when we have them in hand, we can now set aside so that even when that animal dies, hopefully after a long 5-year life as a smoky mouse, we then have its living genetic material, because we know that genetic diversity has collapsed for most mammalian species in Australia.
Why is that important? Why is it vital that we preserve genetic diversity?
Well, genetic diversity is the stuff of evolution. It's what allows species to respond to a changing world and changing environments. But also, the way that we collapsed genetic diversity meant that a lot of that remaining genetic diversity is actually of lower fitness, so that animals suffer these genetic diseases. We see them in humans. We know what it means when you get inbred. You know what's happened to royals all over the world and the diseases they carry because they're inbred. We know that those inbreeding diseases show up in mammals. So, for instance, our first trip to the Grampians in 2012, we caught some swamp rats, one of the most abundant mammals in Australia, and those animals turned out to have this really rare genetic disease called erythropoietic porphyria. Mm-hmm. It's a breakdown in hemoglobin synthesis that leads to deposition of hemoglobin in their bones, and they get red skeletons. And we only discovered that because we collected specimens for the collection to document this work. And so we know that this really abundant mammal actually is collapsing to really small population numbers on the landscape and losing genetic diversity and then suffering genetic diseases resulting from that loss of genetic diversity.
Just briefly, because I know you could wax lyrical for 3 days on this, why does the smoky mouse pull on your heartstrings?
Well, because it's where I started when I came here. So with our first Grampians Bioscan, which was one of the many museum initiatives where we do these multi-taxa surveys of important places. We have other bioscans and bushplants.
There's no romance in this answer.
Sorry.
Why does the smoky mouse pull on your heartstrings?
Because I am interested in collections and temporal changes through time. I don't have this passion for rodents, really, but I have passion for collections, and I have passions for the historical record of what we as humans colonizing the world have done to populations and species.
And the little beings are important. Mm. They are important in ecosystems.
Rodents are extremely important in ecosystems around the world, and they've been important in Australia for the last 5 million years. It's taken them, they didn't got here last, but they did get here 5 million years ago.
Myrene Bellisi, over to you in California. We've got a question here. With the world's worst mammal extinction rate, should we be focused on conserving what we have left? Does de-extinction stop us focusing on conservation? I'm interested in your thoughts on that front. And then I want to come a bit more closely to your work.
Oh, sure. Before I address that, actually, I wanted to add something to what you said about small things. So at the La Brea Tar Pits, where I was for 4 years.
That's a very special site. Really, in the heart of Los Angeles.
Yes. And it is arguably the best ice age fossil locality, it's the best in terms of numbers of specimens, as well as the numbers of species that are preserved there. Los Angeles lies above a large oil field called the Salt Lake Oil Field. On the surface, the oil forms sticky pools of asphalt. And so if you walk across it, you will get stuck. Humans can do that, and so did many other animals and plants.
So it's this incredible resource for you as a paleobiologist.
It's a window into Los Angeles' deep time history. And one of the special things is that the tar pits preserves these large animals, so megafauna, like the saber-toothed cat and the dire wolf, which is real if you watch Game of Thrones. So the tar pits does preserve those large megafauna, right, from the Ice Age, but it also preserves the small things. And as we say, small things tell big stories. For the past 4 years, really, I've been working not on the big animals, but on the smaller ones. So these are what we call mesocarnivores. They're small to medium-sized mammalian carnivores. And they include animals like the bobcat, the gray fox, the spotted and striped skunks. Those species are all still alive today. But the thing is, at the La Brea Tar Pits, there is a great record of those species from the time that the megafauna were still roaming the landscape. So mammoths and mastodons and saber-toothed cats and dire wolves coexisted with these smaller animals. Between 10 and 12,000 years ago, all of that fell apart with the extinction of the large animals. So I think that this story has largely focused on the extinction, but there's also the story of the survivors, right? And so what we know so far of the survivors is that they changed in body size. It just seems like everything was bigger in the Ice Age, even though these are the same species, just different points in time in that species' existence. So why is that? That work is still ongoing. And yeah, I'll be excited to
Interesting. Tune in. The bigger you are, the more vulnerable you are. Andrew Pask, if we did bring the thylacine back, have you been giving some real attention to not just the genomics and fiddling with the genetics to make this possibility a reality, but have you been giving thought to what would happen? And this is a question from Joe. What impact would reintroducing a Tassie tiger back into the environment have on the current ecosystem? And of course, all the other species in Tasmania.
It's a great question.
And what about if we introduced it to the mainland?
That's another really good question, because they used to be abundant across all of mainland Australia. So that's a consideration you could think of, although they didn't persist here more recently. You could certainly have a think about, you know, they may be able to compete with foxes and other introduced species on the mainland as well. But in terms of Tasmania, the thylacine was a cornerstone species in that landscape. It was the only apex predator in that ecosystem. And so when you lose those animals, it does throw that entire ecosystem into imbalance. And a great example of that is something like the devil facial tumour disease. So that's the Tasmanian devil that almost went completely extinct because of this transmissible tumour. And they get this from biting each other's faces. And the longer a sick animal is able to persist in that population, the more disease it can spread and the more quickly it will go through the population. So there's been a lot of modelling to look at what would happen if you had the Tasmanian tiger still around, eating those sick and wounded animals and removing them from the population before they spread that disease. And so a lot of those models suggest it probably wouldn't have led to the almost extinction of the Tassie tiger, Tassie devil. The Tassie devil would have been quite fine probably if it was being predated on still by the Tasmanian tiger. So that's just one example of how those ecosystems really get imbalanced with those things being gone. The other thing we understand about the ecosystems is they do change over time, but they don't change really quickly. So the fact that the Tassie devil's only been gone for 86 years, or probably about, you know, 100 years since they were in a good number, means that, you know, there haven't been so many dramatic changes. There haven't been heaps of other extinction events of smaller marsupials that it would prey on that would really change its ability to fit back into that ecosystem and not just survive, but we would hope that it would be able to thrive once again in that,
you
in
hope.
That area.
Yeah,
and, well, that's, I was going to add, that's one of the big contrasts with the saber-toothed cat, right, is that the saber-toothed cat went extinct, but also going extinct were the mega herbivores of North American Pleistocene. So the only mega herbivore that was left behind was the bison. You lost horses, you lost giant sloths, you lost mastodons, and all these things disappeared, and those were what saber-toothed cats were feeding on. Correct me if I'm wrong, Myrene. And in the case of thylacine, we don't have that. We have the loss of this apex predator, but most of the prey that they would have fed on are still reside in Tasmania. Yeah. And then we have this introduction of these other mesocarnivores. When you have cats and foxes on your landscape, we're spending huge amounts of money and huge amounts of efforts to try to control them, baiting, doing all these controversial things on the landscape. And having apex predators is one way to help displace and control those predators.
Initially, though, we'd only be bringing back one, then maybe two, and then maybe a family. So you're dealing with that question. You bring one back, you bring two back. A question from Joe: if we are to bring back extinct species, is there enough genetic variation for breeding in the future? That's a concern, isn't it?
So one of the great things about this project as well is the thylacine had these beautiful pelts. You know, they're really enigmatic. Museums all over the world wanted them, but there are huge amounts of specimens in collections. There's a huge amount of specimens here at the museum. We're accessing those. We're actually going to sequence over 50 genomes as part of this project. So we're not just going to rebuild that one Tasmanian tiger genome, we're going to sequence 50 genomes. We're going to get a really good understanding of the population diversity, and we will be engineering that back in, because the whole idea is not to bring back one, you know, or two and have that really limited diversity, but to actually bring back a really healthy population that we would hope could re-establish themselves in Tasmania.
But those are all questions. That's what we're going to learn by doing these kind of things. There's lots of questions that aren't answered yet. And then by attempting it, you figure those out. You figure out what genetic diversity you need to keep species alive. That's a question we have for living species. Yeah. How much genetic management do we need to keep these species alive? Where are they imperiled on the landscape? Trying to do it in the thylacine, because it gets interest and brings in new funding sources, is a big initiative that will answer those kind of questions that we have to answer in other wildlife, other species.
So here's a question, though. We've got a question from Anonymous. The Tasmanian tiger today, Triceratops tomorrow. And I'll weave into that from James. With species such as the woolly mammoth, Smilodon, etc., would it be more likely that they be brought back into captivity for study rather than into the wild? And that's a legitimate question, isn't it? Because many people think that this whole exercise of re-engineering beings back into existence is a classic human move. It's the ultimate in human hubris, scientific hubris. Yeah. Oh, well, we stuffed up, so let's just engineer them back into existence. It's sort of a techno-fix solution for what is a much more complex evolutionary history. And so it's great fun. It's really an interesting scientific challenge. Will the animals themselves benefit? Do we know? And what about Triceratops?
Yeah, so I'll start off by saying, so there's no DNA left in dinosaur bones, so we can forget the whole Jurassic Park scenario team. I'm sorry to disappoint everybody. So DNA lasts about, has a half-life of about 500 years. So in a couple of million years of any sample in a museum collection, there's no DNA left. So we can't go back 60 million for dinosaurs, nothing there, unfortunately, for, you know, the big Jurassic Park fans. But it means we're not going to get eaten by T-Rex, which is a good thing. But for the more recent extinctions, you can definitely apply it to anything. I think my point on this would always be, well, we didn't stop to not wipe out these animals. We're not stopping to destroy the environment. We're not stopping to protect these animals. And so you may call it hubris, but I think this is a way of trying to reverse some of those terrible actions that we've done. And I think we would all prefer to not have to engineer animals for us to just do a better job of preserving the environments and really looking after and protecting those species. But we're not doing it. And so I think this is one way of trying to fix some of those wrongs, particularly for something like the Tasmanian tiger, you know, hunted to extinction about 86 years ago. We didn't have the foresight back then or the deep understanding of cornerstone species, apex predators. We didn't understand how unique and important it was. But I think now we can appreciate that. Now we can see the impacts that its loss has had on the ecosystem. And now we have the technology to bring that animal back. So I think, yes, we should be doing this.
Science doesn't happen in a vacuum, though. It is a very human enterprise. Mm. And so a question from Amelia, and I'll put this to you, Kevin. How would we prevent destructive corporations from using de-extinction technology to avoid being held to account for destroying vulnerable habitats? Very interesting question, don't you think?
Well, how are we holding them to account now as they destroy habitats? I mean, we're clear-felling old-growth forests on a daily basis, and, you know, Borneo is collapsing into no forest left. And
But you can hear it now, can't you? You can kind of hear the spin. Well, we're sponsoring the de-extinction project to bring back the thylacine, and then it goes into their annual report and it's all tickety-boo.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's already happening. I mean, the carbon offsets is kind of a way that we do that, right? And so we're just saying, oh, we can, you know, ExxonMobil and other places are having to deal with the excess carbon they can. So they're trying to come up with solutions to that by saying, oh, well, this carbon would have been put in the environment, now it's not. But that's the corporate shell game we're going to have to deal with in our consumer lifestyle.
But it's still enormously complicated and enormously expensive. So it's not something you could just budget for and be like, oh, we can de-extinct 20 species. Like, no, this is an enormous cost.
Yeah, I certainly hope we see that it's like, so it is really expensive, really complicated. Yeah. And maybe then we'll realize, oh, it's going to be a lot cheaper if we maintain the living genetic diversity in species. And I don't think there's anyone on this panel, as any scientist who has the hubris to say, oh, we don't need to worry about living things. We'll just, you know, bring them back when we need to. I don't think there's anyone who thinks that's a viable strategy. It's much more efficient to protect ecosystems. But even though we've been clamoring about it for decades, saying that we're not really doing it effectively and we're not stopping extinction, hopefully this new release from the Australian government will lead to towards zero extinctions. But we're still altering the landscape in massive ways that lead to decline of ecosystems.
When we took to the stage of the Melbourne Museum with this big ideas, the federal government had just released its threatened species plan towards zero extinctions. Now, the plan is said to prioritise 110 species and 20 places. But, of course, Australia's extinction rate is confrontingly high, and many of the world's most unique species call this continent home, so it remains to be seen if it's a case of too little action, too late. Back to the Melbourne Museum with Andrew Pask, Kevin Rowe and Myreen Bellisi. I'm Natasha Mitchell.
And I've got a question for you, Myreen Bellisi, there in California. Someone has asked, should we be bringing back extinct habitats to go along with the extinct species? How would that be balanced with current deforestation issues? That's an interesting challenge because, of course, extinct habitats are hard to tease out, aren't they?
They are sometimes hard to tease out, but we have enough resources as a civilization, I think, to focus on multiple strategies at a time. You know, I think that it is completely possible to work on de-extinction while we are also working on conservation and to work on, you know, restoring habitats, even as we preserve habitats that are currently endangered. Yes, absolutely. We need to work on restoring habitat as well, because, you know, what is a mammoth? What is a woolly mammoth specifically without the steppe tundra that it used to live in, right? Like, it would just be a fuzzy elephant.
So, I mean, there are very focused efforts to try and re-engineer a woolly mammoth back into being. Are you optimistic about that, or do you have concerns and questions about that possibility?
I think it's very exciting. My concerns are, you know, what is a woolly mammoth? Andrew has talked already about the technicalities of how to de-extinct a species. And, you know, it works better if you start from life. And if you're working with something like the woolly mammoth, like, you might have to start with the closest living relative, which would be an elephant. And so is a fuzzy mammoth or fuzzy elephant the same as a woolly mammoth?
I'd be up for a fuzzy elephant, but would the fuzzy elephant be up for existence if it arrived in the 21st century with no other fuzzy elephants to share the planet with?
Yeah. So that's what I also think about. And, you know, part of it's probably me like projecting my like thoughts and dreams onto this one hypothetical fuzzy elephant. But I do wonder, like, how is it to be the first of your species to be brought into being, to be engineered into being? I don't imagine it would be very fun. I mean, it's about this.
I think it would be very well looked after, the first one that was brought back. I don't think it would have to
Well, according to our terms and our construction of what a good life for a fuzzy elephant would be.
But the Mammoth De-Extinction Project, I think, is a really interesting one. It's interesting in comparison to what we're working on with the thylacine. Obviously, it's been extinct for a lot longer. Its closest living relative, the Asian elephant, is a lot closer than what we have for the thylacine. So that means there's actually a lot less edits to make, to build or engineer your mammoth that are required. But then you've got a 22-month gestation that you've got to try and figure out for your embryo. Our marsupials have about a 2-week gestation, so they have maybe 14 days-ish for most of the group of mammal of marsupials that the thylacine was part of. And their babies are the size of a grain of rice. Not even a big grain of rice, the little arborio grain of rice. And so that is much easier for us to figure out how to get that cell to go through to an embryo that you can then bottle feed, basically, to get back into existence. But that's very complicated for the mammoth. So I think, you know, they're huge efforts on both fronts at the moment, and I don't know who will get there first, but it'll be interesting to see.
So a whole range of questions related to that, but I'll come to you, Kevin, first. Just back to the challenge then of using some of these techniques to keeping species back from the brink of extinction that are alive now. So how do you envisage a living biobank, the one that you are creating now and feeding with smoky mouse cells and then eventually other species as well? How do you envisage using that in a practical way?
Well, we already invest a lot in genetic management of species of concern. There's a lot of artificial assisted reproductive technologies, IVF, that are used in species in zoos. And the notion here is that we can provide more of the genetic material from the wild. But also the potential from the biomedical technologies is to take any cell, a skin cell, and turn it into, make it pluripotent, make it like a stem cell, make it allowed to grow into any egg. And scientists, this is not science fiction, did this in 2009 with lab mice. They took the skin cells from a mouse's ear or something and were able to put those, grow those, make, turn them into gametes and then put them into an early stage blastocyst. And the mouse that resulted was the genome of those skin cells. So this is the ability to preserve those cells.
So a cloned mouse.
Yeah, and this is important in like communities like in rhino poaching. So now there's just paper out this year about when a rhino is poached, they can go in and out and try to harvest the cells and protect the cells, and so that they don't lose that animal from the genetic diversities out there. And that's an issue that we've learned to do in species like rhinos, but in flagship species like that, but apply to most of the species. And museums are the only place where we actually study all the species. And we are the place that work on all the diversity of life, and that's what we're trying to put away in our biobank, not just a handful of flagship species, but everything that we work on, especially here in the state of Victoria.
And it's such an interesting history, isn't it? Because many of the great collecting boom of the 19th century that fed museums with collections of specimens, I mean, that collecting boom resulted in many cases in extinction. Or a number of cases, anyway. And now, though, those items in collections are so valuable, so important in understanding...
I don't know of any evidence that collections, building for museum collections, led to declines or extinction of species. The harvesting and over-harvesting and destruction of ecosystems led to declines, and a lot of that was documented by museums from an early stage in the early part of the 20th century, realizing that we were altering our landscapes and trying to document that change and leaving a record. I came from the University of California, Berkeley, the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology there, and the first director of that museum wrote in 1910 that the value of what we do will not be realized for more than a century when the student of the future will want to know about the faunal conditions of California or wherever we now work. And that's where we are now. So we've looked back at those material. We've looked back at the thylacine from 1913. We've looked back to Gould's mouse and other extinct species of rodents to realize what we lost. Now we're trying to prepare for forward when the student of the future is going to look back in a century.
Yeah, that's right. But I guess the interesting point is that these items of extinct animals are so valuable now in museum collections because they can help conserve and protect future species, keep them back from the brink. But also the museums have a different approach to collecting. I mean, this idea that you're building a tissue bank from living animals, a living cell bank. It's not like you're having to kill animals in order to build these precious resources to help you as museum scientists to better understand those animals.
Well, that's a complicated subject. We talked about the road toll in Tasmania on wildlife, 1 million animals a year. You know, each year duck hunters kill something like 600,000 birds in the state of Victoria alone. And over the last 160 years, Museums Victoria has collected around, I'll probably get the number wrong, about 250,000 vertebrate specimens in Victoria. That's less than, on average, less than one specimen per square kilometer. But the times have shifted. I gave a talk last week at the Australian Mammal Society about the value and need for collecting and the minimal impacts. The culture has shifted. We have to make changing decisions about what we can collect.
Could you imagine a species that you're working with, a species of rodent, a precious rodent in a precious habitat, being re-engineered? Could you imagine engineering genes into those communities of rodents so that they are protected from predators?
Well, we're doing
that
in a way now. We have quite a few translocation studies and programs and across Australia where we're trying to move animals around to try to maintain the animal husbandry, maintain the genetic diversity. It's just another tool in that if you can say, so one of the animals we studied was the Gould's mouse, which we thought was completely extinct. It was first discovered on the voyage of the Beagle in 1837, and then last collected by our first curator of zoology, Wilhelm Blandowski, in 1857 in the northwest corner of Victoria. And then we thought it was extinct. And then we sequenced those specimens, both the ones in NHM in London and here in Museums Victoria, and they showed that species survived on a single island off of Western Australia, and it was known as the Shark Bay mouse, Pseudomys fieldi. But we also showed that from those specimens in the 1830s and 1850s, they had high genetic diversity, and that high genetic diversity at the time of their last collections completely collapsed to this single island endemic in the Shark Bay mouse. Mm-hmm. And I know the people working on the Shark Bay mouse recovery, they're putting a lot of investment trying to move them to different islands. They're trying to manage their genetic diversity, but there's almost no genetic diversity left. Genetic diversity is the stuff of evolution, how you respond to a changing climate. All they need is one dramatic change. The Shark Bay mouse, with some dramatic changes to environment, won't have the material to respond to evolution. And we now have the material in the Museum Victoria collection to say this is some of that genetic diversity that was lost. What if we can recover that using the tools we have for
And how close are you to doing that? Will someone do it?
That's exactly what we're doing, right? We're going to engineer back in diversity.
Because you're looking at that in relation to the northern quoll, aren't you?
Right, and I think that will underpin a lot of those projects. I think that, the northern quoll is another great example of why it's so important to develop these technologies. So in the process of engineering our thylacine, we have to make the technology for DNA editing a marsupial and then bringing that animal back. And one of the key projects we're working on from the get-go is with the northern quoll. So the northern quoll's, this beautiful little cat-sized marsupial. They're going extinct in northern Australia because they eat cane toads, the introduced toad, and they're toxic and that just kills the animal and they die. But we know that animals that naturally evolved with cane toads or with that group of toads, they have all evolved resistance to the toxin, so they can eat those toads and they're fine. And it's just one single change in their genome that you need to make an animal resistant to cane toads. And so we can engineer quolls to be cane toad toxin resistant with a very, very simple edit. And then not only will that save the northern quoll from extinction, but they can actually then eat cane toads, which are this terrible ecological disaster. They can actually help control the spread of cane toads, which would be a phenomenal thing. So you can actually, use this technology not just to preserve animals, but actually to act as biological controls, to actually help, deploy better ways of looking after these species. And this is a change that we know naturally evolves in an animal's genome if they have long enough. The unfortunate thing with the northern quoll is it will go extinct before we have another millennia for it to evolve that toxin resistance. So it's just a way really
of re-engineer it
speeding those things up.
But relevant to that, would this ethically affect humanity? Would this give us a god complex? Is that a good thing for society, asks Cy. And then also Peter asks, what are the ethical issues around creating what is in reality a new life form, part Dunnart, part thylacine?
So I think, with the first bit again, I'll say, well, we wipe them out without stopping to consider, were we acting as God? And, we change the landscape around us, we're changing global temperatures, we do things that play God all the time. So I don't see that this is actually good God. This is like New Testament God, not Old Testament God, when we're trying to bring some of these things back, right? So I think, we already have a terrible God complex and at least we'd be applying it in a good way.
Myrene, is this good God or bad God?
I was thinking about it more, is it lawful good or is it chaotic neutral or,
I mean, you're studying species that are long extinct, but they evolved over millennia through a fascinating process that took time. So this idea that we can just, well, re-engineer beings back into existence, what do you make of that? That's at a very different timescale, with all sorts of potential unintended consequences that we can't necessarily predict.
Yeah, I think that all of these are great questions. And I think that you make a very good point of the accelerated timescale. So yeah, I mean, the world is changing at an accelerated timescale at the moment. And so I do think that it makes sense to think about, you know, long-term solutions, but also solutions that might help in the short term or in the shorter term. That these are multiple different selective pressures that are happening faster than they have over the last millions of years, the last millions of years that I have studied personally.
Kevin, would reintroducing the thylacine be a death sentence? This is a question from someone, for already threatened small mammals. This is one of the potential unintended consequences.
Probably not, but we don't really know. And there's a lot of this leaping to, we're just going to throw a big pack of thylacines out there.
Yeah.
This is going to be a lot of research. It's going to take time to figure that out. Mm. And I think the examples that we've done reintroductions of extinct species, locally extinct species like timber wolves in Yellowstone, are a great example of how they were the lifeblood for the whole ecosystem from the highest peaks to the river systems there. And I encourage you to look into that kind of work, the trophic cascades that you get when you reintroduce an apex predator. Because I'll tell you right now, the threatened small mammals, the smoky mouse included, are just imperiled everywhere by cats, foxes, and other introduced herbivores and predators that are just destroying their habitats and consuming them. And it's something we don't know how much to do about it. Right now, they're in Western Australia, they're trying to build like an automatic cat-killing box called the Felixer that shoots a bait. It recognizes the cat, shoots bait at it, and kills it. So there's lots of different technologies that we say. As Myrene said, we're a civilization big enough to come with multiple solutions. But dealing with feral predators and feral cats in Australia is much bigger concern for me than bringing back a native predator like a thylacine. It will not.
So on that question, though, another question from someone, could thylacines help tackle the problem of feral dogs and cats on mainland Australia as well?
That's one of the big ideas, right? And there's a lot of really important research on how dingoes and naturalized dogs affect other predators like foxes and cats. And there's lots of really sophisticated research there in ecological systems that's showing that having dingoes around can help displace and control foxes, and almost certainly a thylacine there would help displace it. They'd also help remove the Tassie devils with facial tumor disease and keep populations healthy. This misnomer of losing of predators are eating prey and hurting prey was something we learned about in the early part of the 20th century in wildlife biology. Aldo Leopold and other people who were out there, their job, like here, was to shoot predators. So we were shooting thylacines because we thought, oh, it'll make for better ecosystems, it'll protect our sheep. And they realized in the early 20th century that shooting a puma did not mean for better deer. It meant for worse deer and worse deer populations, and they declined. So reinstating our predator populations is really critical to saving our small mammals and prey species.
So many questions here. I just want to ask every single one of them. Is it really necessary, someone asks, to reverse extinction? Maybe nature has made its peace with the dodo bird being extinct. Why does this deserve priority public funding?
None of the work I've had has had public funding for trying to bring back the thylacine. So this was a philanthropic donation that was given to me, and also biotech companies that have wanted to invest in driving this technology. So I think no public funding for this. And it's brought millions of dollars to conservation biology for marsupials that would never come through the public funding means. So it's actually been a really effective way of attracting more money to helping the plight of other species, which I think is a really important consideration of this work.
So are people drawn to the novelty of funding this?
Yeah, I think
that
they
has this sort of flow on.
That's it.
Effect.
They really want to see these species brought back, these cornerstone species. And I think we have to develop all these technologies like the DNA editing, like the cloning for marsupials along the way that will have enormous conservation benefits for what we have left and protecting those animals that we have left, as well as one day, hopefully, trying to bring back some of these species that we've lost.
Here's a question. What safeguards would we need to put in place to prevent the exploitation of any species we bring back from extinction? That's a really interesting question. And just taking that to a kind of further degree, here's a thought experiment. As technology advances, asks someone, how do we ensure that rogue nations and corporations won't abuse the technology, that is, bring back Neanderthals to exploit as a form of labour?
People have talked about de-extincting Neanderthals, so that is definitely something that people have proposed
in
the past.
They certainly have.
And we should note Svante Paabo just won the Nobel Prize in medicine, principally the sequencer of the Neanderthal genome. So this is cutting edge science.
Yeah, but I mean, we have the technology. It's around today to do DNA editing to make genomes, you know, completely artificial genomes from the ground up. You don't even have to start with, you know, something that we have. You can actually create whatever you want. So that technology's there. It's available to anybody who has the money and the wherewithal to use those tools. So I do think it then falls on society to think about, what do we want to see done with this technology? Where do we think we need to draw the limits with what we want to do? You know, I wouldn't recommend bringing back dinosaurs if we could get DNA from them. We can't. But if you could, you know, obviously this is not something that there's a habitat for, that there's a good reason for bringing back other than we would want to see it.
Well, Rod here wants to bring back grandma.
That's a lot easier. I get asked about cloning humans all the time. I'm like, we've been able to do that for years.
We already are playing God in this way with human medicine.
Yeah.
And we're spending huge amounts of money globally on trying to grow patient-specific organs from their own cells, and that's going on as part of a way to have us live longer, allow us to, you know, survive our own individual extinctions.
Yeah. Mm.
And what we're suggesting is that bringing those tools to bear on wildlife and all the other species in biodiversity, the other 2 million species, we estimate 10 million species on this planet that we share.
An interesting question for you, Maureen. Do you think that the public will ever actually accept a species brought back via scientific means? And then someone else has asked, what impact will de-extinction have on evolution? And I guess I'll couple those by asking, you know, there's this idea of the natural, which is a little bit of a furphy, really, because what is natural in on this planet of ours, given our the breadth of our impact? But what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, natural and artificial, those terms come with value judgments, right? Mm-hmm. And so does, you know, native and introduced, like things like that. The question is, should those value judgments be there, or should species be evaluated based on their function in the ecosystem that they're in, or the ecosystem that they're engineered into?
We have engineered livestock and plant crops and things around us all the time. So I always think, you know, we already have, as a globe, accepted these things. They're out there. And now we'd be applying those technologies to native animals, at least, for benefit, rather than just for commercial gain or for, you know, feeding the starving world or those sorts of things.
Yeah, so going back to the thylacine, I have heard that there are a lot of people who would like the thylacine back and who, you know, there have been hundreds of sightings over the last century. And so
non-credible.
Non-credible. But I imagine that, you know, given that interest in that species, I think that people might be more likely to accept the thylacine. Mm. But generally, I think that, you know, there is a value judgment, I think, on herbivores versus carnivores as well. So, you know, if it's an apex predator, it would probably be not super accepted.
It's a very interesting question. We need to wrap now, but I'm just going to throw one more question that someone's asked about. Is extinction reversal a way to adapt to climate change by bringing back species better adapted to our changing environment? Kevin?
I think recovering species that can, and recovering the genetic diversity that's lost in species to allow them to respond to a changing world, is part of what's behind reversing extinction and de-extinction. I definitely think it's part of dealing with a changing world. The less diversity we have, the less we're able to respond to a changing world.
Andrew?
Yeah, there are projects at the University of Melbourne now looking at engineering coral to survive warming temperatures in the ocean and also acidification, in order to make sure that the reefs survive, you know, as a hub for so much biodiversity. And so absolutely, this is one way forward that we can engineer to maintain some of our biodiversity. Obviously, it's not ideal. We don't want to have to engineer our animals in order to survive. But as if this might be the thing that we're faced with. We either engineer animals and allow them to be able to survive and keep that biodiversity, or they'll be lost forever.
Do you have a sense that this might happen, that you might bring back the thylacine within your lifetime?
Yeah, absolutely. I really do.
That's a yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we just narrow the time frame a little bit.
Yeah, people always want to. I reckon in 10 years' time we'll have edited cells, and I would hope that we are at the point then that we can actually turn those cells back into whole living animals. So I'm hoping a decade to be able to start to bring back the Thylacine and see, you know, and then it would, you would have to sell it though for 20 or more years before you would release it in Tasmania.
So,
right?
so it's not
like you bring it back and let it go. It's still a long process.
And these two questions, I'll combine them as the last question. Sally asks, what's the importance of learned behaviour when reintroducing? Would prey know how to avoid predators? Would predators hunt well without learning from adults?
Yep.
And then also Peter Brown asks, what are the animal husbandry challenges of raising a thylacine joey to a fully functional adult? Who are the animal husbandry partners for this project? So you get it, you've got to get that sorted out within 10 years.
Yeah, so the animals really have a lot of behaviours pre-programmed in their brain. And a great example of this is domesticated cats, right? They've been domesticated for thousands of generations, but if they see a mouse run in front of them, they're going to run and pounce on that mouse. We can take orphaned animals out of the wild and hand rear them, and they will still go out and hunt and have that same role in the ecosystem as the original animal. And so we're really confident that, you know, if you bring back a thylacine, it's going to know what to do, it's going to know what to eat and how to hunt back in that environment. Marsupials don't have enormous brains, they have pretty small brains. And so that probably means they have a lot more pre-programmed and less learnt behaviours that we think actually bode really well for the thylacine being able to figure these things out. But until we do it, we don't really know. And that's one of the things that we will study intensively.
So related to cats, the mountain lions, they have been around Southern California for tens of thousands of years. They used to coexist with the Western horse. So horses, millions of years ago, and then they went extinct at the end of the last ice age about 10,000 years ago. Mountain lions persisted, so then mountain lions lived without horses on the landscape for, you know, for millennia. But then now we have horses again imported from Europe, and we have donkeys as well through domestication. And there are donkeys now roaming the landscape with these mountain lions.
Uh-huh.
And donkeys are definitely introduced. Somehow mountain lions, we have just documented mountain lions preying on these wild donkeys. So there is, yeah, I think that there is some behavior that seems to be, you know, mountain lions were able to prey on horse-like animals even after millennia of not having seen one.
So. Ice Age behaviour reincarnated. What a fascinating discussion. And the questions have been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for asking them. And we've still got Myrene. Myrene Bellisi, thank you so much for staying up until 2:30 in the morning.
Oh, no, it's only 1:30.
Oh, okay.
For having me.
You're getting a very special applause. And thank you to Andrew Pask and Kevin Rowe. And thank you to all of you for being part of the Future Forums here at the museum. Cheers. On Big Ideas, Andrew Pask from the University of Melbourne, where he heads up the Tigger Lab. That's a nod to one of my all-time favourite characters in Winnie the Pooh there. In this case, Tigger stands for the Thylacine Integrated Genomic Restoration Research Lab. Dr. Kevin Rowe is Senior Curator of Mammals at Museums Victoria, and Dr. Myrene Bellisi is a curator at the Raymond M. Elf Museum of Paleontology in California. And I'm Natasha Mitchell. Big thanks to Alice Gibbons and the Melbourne Museum team. You can follow Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app, and we'd love you to recommend the podcast to friends if you particularly love an episode. And happy 30th birthday, Jurassic Park. You don't look a day over. When did the dinosaurs go extinct? 65 million years? Aging well.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.